At this time, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW. It's not a thing that we call the tech net. It's a place where a little bit of education takes place about this complicated hobby of ham radio. Mel and Dick and their friends try to answer your questions about what kind of a rig, what kind of an antenna, what kind of a transmitter and transmission line, how to make it all work better, how does it work, how does digital television work. Any subject of interest to amateur radio operators is appropriate to the TechNet. Occasionally those subjects get pretty far and wide. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in might sound like this, WA2RYY, Joe, and yes. Do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
WA2RYY,
WB2QEQ, Len.
Okay, we've got both Joe and Len. I'm going to assume that both are with a yes. They've got their subjects to be discussed, comments to make, questions to ask. Any other check-ins, please give me your call and your name at the time.
K2TWS, yes.
Yes.
Okay, we got Les. And I think I heard N2NNU, but very, very noisy if that was you, Alex. Thank you for Les. And Alex, was that you?
Yes. Is that better now? N2NNU, yes.
Quite a bit better. A little bit noisy. Anyone else to check in?
This is WS2N Paul with a space report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine. Great to hear from you, Paul. And one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KB1NNH, Jerry, no.
Okay, Jerry with a no. Probably from the New England area. First guy with a real yes was Joe, WA2RYY. How
go ahead.
Television measurements going, Joe. You got it, Joe.
I haven't made many digital television measurements. I just occasionally can pick up different stations from different areas.
Roger, man. Roger that.
Word. Copy, copy, copy. I do. This was right up your alley, too.
Okay. Mel and Dick are all ears. You got it, Joe.
Okay, I have an antenna which I acquired. Actually, I acquired two antennas which are 450 beam antennas, or in a 450 frequency range as far as antennas. Actually, they're probably closer to 420, I believe, the way they were built. I want to utilize both antennas in the 435 frequency range. They're cut a little lower in frequency right now, apparently. The antennas have, 28 elements each. And the boom length is about 21 feet long. What other information would you need off these things to help calculate how much I have to remove metal, any metal, to raise the frequency slightly?
Now, you've got a fairly complicated question there, Joe. It's not going to be a great, easy answer. If for a fact you knew the exact frequency range that the antenna was designed for, let's assume that it was designed for 223 megacycles. I just picked a number out of the air. And assume that it had high performance on 223 megacycles. And then if you scaled every dimension, length and positions, by the difference in wavelengths, by the ratio of the wavelengths of a 432 versus 423 megacycles, you calculate the wavelength, and if it's a 4% shorter, and you make every element shorter by 4%, and change every spacing by 4%, in theory, you would get the exact same performance on 432 that you had at 423, from my example. One piece of good news is that the element lengths are a lot more sensitive than the element spacings. So that, as a first experiment, I would change all the element lengths, each one of them by that ratio of the wavelengths, the new 90% chance of medium good success. The spacings usually are not quite as sensitive as the lengths. To change the spacings is going to be a bit of a pain. A whole lot of new drilling of holes on the boom, and some of them, the holes are going to be such a small amount of motion, particularly the ones up close to the driven elements, that you'll end up using a rat tail file and making the hole egg shape because the movement will be so small for some of the close ones. So try it without moving the element spacings. But don't be fooled by standing wave ratio. Lots of people think that, okay, when I go to the new frequency, the standing wave ratio went to pot, all I've got to do is retune the driven element. Not true. Yagi design is a whole lot of interplay between all of those directors and that driven element. That director string is a synthesized slow wave structure with a particular velocity profile. That's a fancy way of saying the signal that travels down the middle of that boom encounters all of those directors, which are dipole-like structures, a little bit shorter than a half wavelength. They act like a capacitor, and the wave travels a little bit more slowly down the center of the boom than it does out in free space. That's part of where the
repeater, timeout.
That's where the focusing action comes from. A double convex magnifying glass does something similar. That wave travels to the center of the magnifying glass more slowly for a longer distance than it does out to the perimeter. That's how it does the focusing. And your director string is trying to do that. If you plotted real gain of a Yagi versus frequency, you would find out that when you go lower in frequency than the design frequency, the gain falls off kind of slowly. When you go higher in frequency than design frequency, the gain falls off kind of slowly at first, and then it takes a nosedive. So the higher frequency use of a Yagi is the more troublesome one, so to speak. So I guess I'm recommending that you go and do the experiment, because maybe the antenna, if it's tuned to 420 and you're not using 420, if the antenna is not very useful to you right now, so go ahead and start shortening the elements. I've had a discussion with Alex on this subject during the week in which we discussed the fact that if I was tuning a Yagi in the backyard on a very sensitive ratiometry antenna range, and you can read about that in the February 1976 issue of QST, and if you're an ARRL member, that's on the archives where, as a member, you're allowed to recall that article and read it right on your screen. Okay, that ratiometry antenna range can easily resolve a 20th of a dB of gain difference, 0.05 dB of gain difference. So when you're tuning individual elements by standing on a ladder alongside of the Yagi that you're tuning up, and on a long stick you're holding little pieces of copper tape, and you hold a piece of copper tape on the long stick where you're out of the field, near the tip of a particular director. You're adding capacitance to the director, and the antenna is now, that director is now tuned to a lower frequency, and you make a judgment. The gain went up or down. That tells you which way you want to change the length of that director. Take a slightly larger piece of copper foil, hold it near the center of a director parallel to it, and you're canceling the magnetic field in that area, and you're tuning the element to a higher frequency. So by holding pieces of copper tape near the tips or near the center of an individual director, you can electrically change the frequency of that director, frequency of resonance, and see whether or not the gain increases or decreases. So,
repeater, timeout.
So you could, in theory, do this experiment in a non-destructive manner, where you're not permanently changing the length of the elements, and it's kind of hard to add them back again. Well, you can by putting pieces of copper tape on the end of an element, or, you know, top hat capacitor, so to speak. You can restore the length of an element electronically, but it's not as comfortable to go that way. What Alex and I discussed is that Alex proposed to then take a wide piece of copper tape, I'm going to pick a number, 1.5 inches wide, the whole length of the boom, and lay it alongside of that boom, parallel to the boom, over each one of the directors to electronically tune them to a higher frequency as a method of raising the center frequency of his particular Yagi. I told him I'd give him a 50-50 or so percent probability of success by doing that simple retuning arrangement by that manner. The exact solution would be the copper tape would have to be wider and more narrow in some areas because not every one of the directors, when you go to the new frequency, wants to be raised by the exact same percentage. A Yagi design is a fairly elaborate thing where each one of those directors has a certain diameter, a certain length, and a certain position in space. Let me drop. And if you go to a really good modeling program, you can plug in all those parameters, and it'll tell you what the performance is going to be. When it comes to a Yagi with 28 elements, I think you're getting to the threshold where I'm not sure that the available programs are accurate with that number of elements. Very similar to what happens when you're tuning a very precise filter. The available programs can no longer do a good job of modeling a bandpass filter that has more than 20 elements. I know of one that I needed professionally that had 29 elements, and so the modeling programs got them into the ballpark, but they had to do manually tweaking after that to really make the filter do its job. 28 element Yagi, I'm a little bit afraid, might fall into the same category. Neck and mini neck and similar modeling programs, YO, Yagi optimization. Some of those, unless you're using a really fast machine, are going to give you some grief when you try to put in that much data. On top of that, even when you use any of these Yagi modeling programs, they get you close to the right design, but if you're really a persnickety guy that wants that last half dB of gain, you're going to want to do some manual tweaking anyhow. So I know I haven't given you a nice, simple answer you'd like to have. You've asked for a pretty complicated thing here, Joe. It's going to be a bit of a challenge, and not many guys other than Mel, K2KEY, would take on a challenge like this one. So let me turn it back to you, Joe, and let's see if I hope I haven't thoroughly discouraged you. I'm just sort of letting you know that you're walking into a little bit of a minefield here. It's not going to be super easy to do exactly what you want. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K2RIW in the Tech Minute.
Comment, then, to any.
Okay, we'll get pick up Alex in a second. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, well, I don't plan on using the antenna in the total length of 21 feet. I'm going to probably use it about a length of about 10 feet, and that's probably part of the next part of my question, is what would you estimate the gain of an antenna like this actually would be in its totality, with having 26 directors driven on?
Rounded out by some mysterious noise that came in. If you're going to use 10 feet of the 21 feet of that Yagi, and if you do a good job of tuning the elements on that 10 feet, you'll get about 14 dB of gain over dipole. I know that from my experience of a 13.5-foot Yagi is capable of giving you 15 dB of gain, the so-called RIW-19 Yagi. When you just chop off some of the directors out in front of a Yagi, whether or not you still got a good Yagi design left is not clear. The DL6WU Yagi design, Dr. Gunter Hock, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform, came up with a series of Yagis that appeared in the German magazine starting about 30 years ago, which were an extremely forgiving design. It was a kind of a tapered design in which you could decide how many of the elements you're going to lay down, and the Yagi gave you 95% of the potential performance. There were other Yagi designs which were a little bit more persnickety, where you start chopping off elements until you retune all the remaining ones, you don't have a very good Yagi. So you'll end up using a rat tail file and making the whole egg shape, because the movement will be so small for some of the close ones. So try it without moving the element spacings. But don't be fooled by standing wave ratio. Lots of people think that, when I go to the new frequency, the standing wave ratio went to pot, all I've got to do is retune the driven element. Not true. Yagi design is a whole lot of interplay between all of those directors and that driven element. That director string is a synthesized slow wave structure with a particular velocity profile. That's a fancy way of saying the signal that travels down the middle of that boom encounters all of those directors, which are dipole-like structures, a little bit shorter than a half wavelength. They act like like a capacitor, and the wave travels a little bit more slowly down the center of the boom than it does out in free space. That's part of where the...
Repeater, time out.
That's where the focusing action comes from. A double convex magnifying glass does something similar. That wave travels through the center of the magnifying glass more slowly for a longer distance than it does out to the perimeter. That's how it does the focusing. And your director string is trying to do that. If you plotted real gain of a Yagi versus frequency, you would find out that when you go lower in frequency than the design frequency, the gain falls off kind of slowly. When you go higher in frequency than design frequency, the gain falls off kind of slowly at first, and then it takes a nosedive. So the higher frequency use of a Yagi is the more troublesome one, so to speak. So I guess I'm recommending that you go and do the experiment, because maybe the antenna, if it's tuned to 420 and you're not using 420, if the antenna is not very useful to you right now, so go ahead and start shortening the elements. I've had a discussion with Alex on this subject during the week in which we discussed the fact that if I was tuning a Yagi in the backyard on a very sensitive ratiometry antenna range, and you can read about that in the February 1976 issue of QST, and if you're an ARRL member, that's on the archives where, as a member, you're allowed to recall that article and read it right on your screen. Okay, that ratiometry antenna range can easily resolve a 20th of a dB of gain difference, 0.05 dB of gain difference. So when you're tuning individual elements by standing on a ladder alongside of a Yagi that you're tuning up, and on a long stick you're holding little pieces of copper tape, and you hold a piece of copper tape on the long stick where you're out of the field, near the tip of a particular director, you're adding capacitance to the director, and the antenna is now, that director is now tuned to a lower frequency, and you make a judgment. The gain went up or down. That tells you which way you want to change the length of that director. Take a slightly larger piece of copper foil, hold it near the center of a director parallel to it, and you're canceling the magnetic field in that area, and you're tuning the element to a higher frequency. So by holding pieces of copper tape near the tips or near the center of an individual director, you can electrically change the frequency of that director, frequency of resonance, and see whether or not the gain increases or decreases. So,
repeater, timeout.
So you could, in theory, do this experiment in a non-destructive manner, where you're not permanently changing the length of the elements, and it's kind of hard to add them back again. Well, you can by putting pieces of copper tape on the end of an element, or, you know, top hat capacitor, so to speak. You can restore the length of an element electronically, but it's not as comfortable to go that way. What Alex and I discussed is that Alex proposed to then take a wide piece of copper tape, I'm going to pick a number, 1.5 inches wide, the whole length of the boom, and lay it alongside of that boom, parallel to the boom, over each one of the directors to electronically tune them to a higher frequency as a method of raising the center frequency of his particular Yagi. I told him I'd give him a 50-50 or so percent probability of success by doing that simple retuning arrangement by that manner. The exact solution would be the copper tape would have to be wider and more narrow in some areas, because not every one of the directors, when you go to the new frequency, wants to be raised by the exact same percentage. A Yagi design is a fairly elaborate thing where each one of those directors has a certain diameter, a certain length, and a certain position in space. Let me drop. And if you go to a really good modeling program, you can plug in all those parameters and it'll tell you what the performance is going to be. When it comes to a Yagi with 28 elements, I think you're getting to the threshold where I'm not sure that the available programs are accurate with that number of elements. Very similar to what happens when you're tuning a very precise filter. The available programs can no longer do a good job of modeling a bandpass filter that has more than 20 elements. I know of one that I needed professionally that had 29 elements, and so the modeling programs got them into the ballpark, but they had to do manually tweaking after that to really make the filter do its job. 28 element Yagi, I'm a little bit afraid, might fall into the same category. Neck and mini neck and similar modeling programs, YO, Yagi optimization. Some of those, unless you you're using a really fast machine, they're going to give you some grief when you try to put in that much data. On top of that, even when you use any of these Yagi modeling programs, they get you close to the right design, but if you're really a persnickety guy that wants that last half dB of gain, you're going to want to do some manual tweaking anyhow. So I know I haven't given you a nice, simple answer you'd like to have. You've asked for a pretty complicated thing here, Joe. It's going to be a bit of a challenge, and not many guys other than Mel, K2KEY, would take on a challenge like this one. So let me turn it back to you, Joe, and let's see if I hope I haven't thoroughly discouraged you. I'm just sort of letting you know that you're walking into a little bit of a minefield here. It's not going to be super easy to do exactly what you want. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment, Antoine, any.
Okay, we'll get pick up Alex in a second. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, well, I don't plan on using the antenna in the total length of 21 feet. I'm going to probably use it about a length of about 10 feet. And that's probably part of the next part of my question, is what would you estimate the gain of an antenna like this actually would be in its totality, with having 26 directors driven on the antenna?
It out by some mysterious noise that came in. If you're going to use 10 feet of the 21 feet of that Yagi, and if you do a good job of tuning the elements on that 10 feet, you'll get about 14 dB of gain over dipole. I know that from my experience of a 13.5-foot Yagi is capable of giving you 15 dB of gain, the so-called RIW-19 Yagi. When you just chop off some of the directors out in front of a Yagi, whether or not you still got a good Yagi design left is not clear. The DL6WU Yagi design, Dr. Gunter Hock, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform, came up with a series of Yagis that appeared in the German magazine starting about 30 years ago, which were an extremely forgiving design. It was a kind of a tapered design in which you could decide how many of the elements you're going to lay down, and the Yagi gave you 95% of the potential performance. There were other Yagi designs which were a little bit more persnickety, where you start chopping off elements until you retune all the remaining ones, you don't have a very good Yagi. So which one of those designs is your Yagi is an interesting question. Don't be discouraged. I'm just letting you know that it's not a simple issue. Some Yagis, when you chop off some of the elements up front, an awful lot of retuning of the remaining elements is required in order to get reasonable performance. In the case of the Gunter Hock designs, that's not true. Now, one of the things that Gunter Hock did do is he came up with a beautiful formula. Let me drop. You plug in the boom length of your Yagi in wavelengths to the Gunter Hock formula, and he'll tell you exactly how many decibels of gain over dipole or over isotropic that length of boom is capable of giving you, assuming it has a good number of directors, driven element, and reflector properly sized in the right position on that boom. In other words, the maximum gain you can get out of a Yagi is primarily a function of how long is the boom. And that, of course, is not exactly common sense, because there are people in the past who will take, 10 feet of boom and put 15 elements on it. Another guy puts 20 elements on the same length of boom and expects to get a hell of a lot more gain. That may not be true. On top of that, there are other people who think back from the 1956 articles that appeared in QST magazine that ultra-wide spacing of the elements would give you a lot higher gain. That's not exactly true. Each of these are much more simplistic statements than reality. Let's see what Alex is going to say about all this. N2NNU, K2RIW in the second net. You got it, Alex.
Okay, Dick, please let me know if I'm capable. Over.
You are 90% voice, 10% noise, very copyable. Please proceed.
Yeah, okay, this wind screwed up all my antennas, the
his antenna is down, and this 2 meters antenna is probably off axis now. Anyhow, I wanted to comment about the 22-element Yagi. I think it's not realistic to modify it. I think it might be much cheaper and easier to buy a new one. I had some problems with the 11-element. That boiled down to be a problem in the feeder rather than in the antenna. However, I went and I simulated that little piece of metal, the dig that you suggested. As it boils down, that you can actually use rectangular foil, but at different distances from the center of the boom of the element. So then you end up with a wavy rectangular form. So that took about 3 days to simulate, but it didn't. I don't think it's feasible mechanically and whatnot, so I left it as it is, and I pursued the problems I had, and they boiled down that it was a wet 9913 cable. Back to you.
Okay, that's an extremely good experiment you did there, Alex. And just like I predicted, you wanted the answer to be that a certain width of copper foil placed near the directors would tune them all to a higher frequency and you'd have a new Yagi design. When you did your optimization, you found out that you wanted that piece of copper foil a different spacing from each one of the directors. Now, you did the optimization by allowing the spacing of the copper foil near each director to change. You could have done the optimization by allowing the width of the copper foil to change near each director and make all the spacings the same. In other words, they all lay across the director string, but the width of the foil changes in the vicinity of each director. That will give you another optimization, and it's an interesting science experiment. I'm not sure it's a practical way to go, but an interesting science experiment. Let me turn it back to you, Alex, and see if that made sense, what I just said. N2 and NU, K2LIW.
Yes, that's how I started up. However, when I saw the complicated form that I have to cut off a metal, I said, wow, that is not something that I can do easily. Some elements were very thin, some elements were very wide. So I said, well, wait a second, can I do the same thing by changing the spacing between the copper foil and the element? And that, I think, was a more elegant solution. Otherwise, I have to be a very precise metal sheet cutter. There's a chuck, 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 and only the distance is modified by some supports, plastic supports to the boom. Back to you.
Yeah, it's my gut feel from my experience with Yagi tuning, and I've done an awful lot of it, a few thousand hours of Yagi tuning on various frequencies. Once you found an optimum design, you could do it by making a gradual taper of the copper foil between the elements. It doesn't have to be an exotic stepped taper, although that may be the way you modeled it, and I can understand that. It's a simpler way of modeling it. But it could be done in a more continuous manner. Once the design is settled, to fabricate that piece of metal wouldn't be so difficult if you wanted to do it over and over again. But you've said the right words. For a person of your resources and for a person of Joe's resources, if he wants a 10-element Yagi, either build or go out and buy a 10-element Yagi might be a little bit easier. Unless he's of the opinion that this 21-foot boom 28-element thing of his is not going to be used any other way, so he might as well start modifying it. So we've given you a couple of approaches. Neither one of them is going to be a silver bullet easy way of doing things, Joe. You're asking for something fairly complicated. The total number of variables involved with a Yagi design, where each element, in theory, could be a different diameter, a different length, and a different position in three-dimensional space. If you allowed all of those variables to go up and down, and you did an optimum Yagi design for a given boom length, if you had an extremely accurate modeling program, you better be using a supercomputer and have a lot of computing time available to you, because it's not a simple problem. You're literally going to be inverting a complex matrix with a lot of variables, and the word matrix complex variable inversion. Those words may roll off the tongue very easily. You actually write a computer program to do that. and that's going to keep you up pretty late, quite a few nights of the week, if you know what I mean. So good luck with that experiment, Joe. I just don't want to give you false hopes that it's going to be falling off a log easy. What you're asking for is not easy, but doable. And with the right kind of an antenna range, like that ratiometry antenna range, it would be like a blind man walking up a hill to do it as an empirical experiment. Within seconds, you'll get an
repeater. Time out.
Within seconds, you'll get an answer on each individual element. Does it want to be longer or shorter? If you were doing the ratiometry antenna range tuning procedure, as I said, February 1976 QSD Magazine is where I had an article on the subject, and that procedure is now being used by arguably one of the world's best antenna ranges, the Romare Development Center near Utica, New York. WA2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
KC2QAQ.
Glenn recognized, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
This, the antenna's put together as far as the driven element goes. It's something that resembles a folded dipole where actually the gamma match is touching the tile. It touches it at one point near the tip of the antenna. It has 1 feed point, but it has a coax cable coming out the back of this coupling assembly that just goes out of one port and back into another. It must feed these parts of the to each half of the dipole, but the dipole actually has a metal... looks like a metal block because the actual gamma match, I guess what you would call it, is fairly thin. That's about 16th of an inch aluminum, and the elements, all the elements are about 1/8 inch aluminum. And the gamma match currently is almost at the end of the travel as far as where it happens to be. That's what makes me think this thing is just at the low end of the 420 band or something like that. I also noticed something that the directors seem to increase in space going between D1 to D7. And once I get past D7 to all the way up to D26, the spacing really didn't significantly increase very much. Neither did the length. I'll give an example. D1 is 12.5 inches. D7 is 11 5/8. D6 is 11 5/8. And D26 is 11 1/2. And the maximum spacing I saw at between D25 and D26 is like 9 1/4 inches. That seems to be fairly constant between, like, say, D7 to D26. So they don't really change very much. That's why I'm thinking I can take about 20 feet off, 10 feet off this antenna, and probably I may lose some gain. Well, actually, what do you think of the lose as far as total gain? So I'm not really interested in the directivity too much, or the gain is more of an important factor, because I'm using these things for a point-to-point type of installation. So... I don't know what you said. Typically, a 10-foot boom would give you 13, 14 dB of gain or something like that. And so I guess 21 feet would, what would you estimate that in nominally to be?
Short comment. Okay, Alex after Glenn. A 21-foot long boom Yagi on 432 megacycles, if it was really well tuned, could give you as much as 18 dB of gain over dipole. Very rough number. And you're going to get something more like 14 or 15 with 10 foot of boom. It's not quite 3 dB more every time you double the boom length. It's a little bit longer than that, according to the formula from Gunter Hawk. A large number of Yagi designs have very close spacing with the directors that are closest to the driven element, and then the spacing grows to larger numbers as you get further out in front. Large number of Yagi designs do that. That's not unusual. And just because the spacing gets larger out in front doesn't mean that those directors out there are not working real hard. It's a good design. The ones out front, the 10 directors out front can be working equally as hard as the 10 directors that are up close to the driven element. And let me tell you one other vital piece of information about a Yagi. And that is, once all your directors are electrically the right length and are physically in the right position in three-dimensional space, that is the Yagi design. All the driven element has to do is radiate in a dipole-like manner and give you a good impedance match to your particular feed line. That's all it's got to do. Now, whether you feed the driven element by T-match, folded dipole, gamma match, a triple wire design, or any of the other gamma, delta, there's a zillion different ways you can feed the driven element. Doesn't matter. As long as it radiates like a dipole, is in the vicinity of a half wavelength long, and gives you a good impedance match. That combined with the Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, except for the first one, where it's Chapter 3, and you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, it'll tell you exactly what resistive component you're going to get from a dipole versus its length and diameter, and what reactive component. So, your particular Yagi design, where you would ordinarily start off with a driven element in free space that has 70 ohms, 72 ohms of impedance, but you put that driven element in the middle of your particular Yagi design, maybe the driven element now looks like it's got 21 ohms of impedance instead of 72. And what do you have to do to raise the 21 ohms to 50? You could go crazy with all kinds of exotic feeding mechanisms, or by those Brown and Woodward curves, you could say, hey, if I make the driven element longer, the resistive element, the resistive component goes up. Make it long enough until the resistive component reaches 50.0 ohms. Aha. Now the resistive component is great. However, you will have some inductive reactants left over. By putting a simple shunt capacitor across the driven element in the center, you now cancel just a little bit of interaction between the two. But with the right kind of a Viswater technique setup, you'll zero in on that design immediately. In other words, you can do everything about impedance matching the driven element, no matter what method is presently being used to mechanically feed it. Just by adjusting the length and being willing to put a stray capacitor across the center, and you will come up with a perfect impedance match. That's an extremely well-kept secret. I tried getting that published in the United States. Let me drop. And the United States magazines are not interested. They think it's too simplistic. Everybody understands the dipole. Oh, really? When that got published in Australia and New Zealand, they loved it and said, boy, why didn't somebody tell me this earlier? You can read about that by going to the WA1MBA website, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org, and you go to the bottom of his main page, and you'll see the K2RIW Yagi information, and now you can read the exact details of how to carry out perfect impedance matching. And why should you care about perfect impedance matching? And the answer is, if you're a serious guy in 432, you've got a real good low noise amplifier that was carefully tuned on a automatic noise figure indicator, and the automatic noise figure indicator presented exactly 50.0 ohms to that low noise amplifier while you were tuning it. If your antenna doesn't look like 50.0 ohms resistive, even on a rainy day, then your LNA is not going to give the same performance. The average gas FET, the noise figure goes all over the place when you change the impedance it sees. So you're seeking one-to-one standing wave ratio, a perfect impedance match on the driven element, not because you're a persnickety guy, because you want full performance out of your low noise amplifier, if you're a serious moon bouncer. If you're willing to sacrifice a dB of noise figure on the LNA, then don't worry about this detail. Okay, we got Glenn and Alex in that order. Glenn first, KC2QIQ. What would you do in this situation, Glenn? You got it.
I'd buy the right antenna for the job. But since I've got the Yagi Meister on here, and by the way, good evening, Dick, and I've got a couple of questions for you, something that I've always been wondering about, but always keep on forgetting to ask. On Yagi antenna, you know, lengths of the elements and spacings, like you're saying, you know, you get the modeling programs, and there's a lot of articles written on it. But one thing that's always left me guessing is when you start getting into VHF, UHF, and even higher with Yagis, what effects does the boom start having on it? Because, you know, obviously if you want to go longer and longer in length, you want to keep the strength in the boom, so you want to go larger in diameter. But as you go higher in frequency, the lengths of the elements are getting shorter. Is the boom ever start interfering with the general performance from, let's say, the calculations for length and you know, spacings? KC2QIQ, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, good question, Glenn. The boom can give you a huge effect. If you're foolish enough to just simply drill holes in the boom and mount the elements directly through those holes, so the elements are in direct contact with the boom, you're in a heap of trouble if you have more than about three or four elements. You go to about 8, 10 or more elements. Each of those elements that are in direct aluminum-to-aluminum contact with the boom, when the Yagi is brand new, will immediately outdoors start building up of aluminum oxide, and 2 years later, you go down that string of your elements with an ohmmeter, and you'll find out that more than half the elements make no contact at all to that boom. And if the boom was an inch and a half in diameter, you could say each one of your directors has now changed not quite an inch and a half in length as they broke contact with the boom. So that so-called detuning effect of the Yagi happens very slowly day to day. You learn to live with it. You don't know that you slowly lost a whole lot of gain and a whole lot of pattern and performance and whatever. Guys who know that are now using these shoulder bushings that are made out of some kind of a plastic to insulate the elements from the boom. The so-called K2RIW insulated Yagi, 19-element Yagi, uses that design. And that was a somewhat unique idea in 1978, and it has caught on very well since. So assuming now that your elements are insulated from the boom, so at least they're going to keep their same gain versus year after year, the next thing you want to worry about is as the boom grows larger in diameter, the presence of the boom is slightly shunting the magnetic field created by the resonance of each element near the center of the element. And that's where the boom is located. So just like when you hold a piece of copper foil and the end of a stick parallel to an element, and you're tuning it to a higher frequency, the presence of the boom shunting the magnetic field is doing the same thing. Gunter Hock, among other people, let's see, both of this Vicky article, which was done by National Bureau of Standards, a Yagi tuning article published way back in 1978, and the articles by Gunter Hock, DL6WU, do have some approximations for boom diameter versus element detuning effect in percentage, and you can compensate by readjusting the length of the element accordingly, depending on the diameter of your particular boom. I wonder if I made some sense the way I worded it, Glenn. KC2.
Repeater. Time out.
KC2QIQ. K2RIW. You got it, Glenn.
No, very well stated. I kind of figured that there was going to be some kind of an effect of shunting as, you know, the boom was getting larger and or the elements are getting smaller or some combination of both. But no, that's very interesting. You know, it's something you don't hear talked about all that often, especially with Yagi designs, and, you know, especially if you're taking an antenna designed for one frequency and then adjusting it for another with a certain length, you know, the boom is going to be part of it, too. So unless you're, you know, if you're trying to go directly from calculations to performance, there might be some other, things that come into play. Also, I was wondering about Gunter Hock. Does he have any good publications or books to look up? I can probably take a look on the web, but you might be familiar with something right offhand that you could recommend.
KY, we're coming.
Bell recognized. Yeah, Gunter has a lot of articles in the German magazine. Has he published a book? Not to my knowledge. Also, the very first Yagi with any significant performance on 432 was the Ed Tilton Yagi, W1HDQ, the guy who invented World Above 50 Megacycles, founder of World Above 50 Megacycles, monthly article in QSC. The 13-element Yagi he came out with in, I guess it was around 1971 or so, 72, used 1/8-inch diameter elements that were directly mounted through the boom. For mechanical reasons as well as electronic reasons, I strongly do not recommend you use 1/8-inch diameter elements on 432. Use at least 3/16-inch diameter. Much less subject to detuning by raindrops, much mechanically stronger, and not as much detuning because of the element shunting effect because of the presence of the boom. I think that answers part of your questions. Okay, we'll take Alex and then Mel in that order. Alex and to NNU, go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. I just wanted to make a first comment that if your gamma match seems to be out of range, check your cable. I cursed in my beard for about 3 days because of it, and then I realized that it's the cable. So try that first. If the gamma match seems to be out of range when you all insert it and you need more capacitance, more than likely you will need to change the cable and to NNU. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if you're really doing a thorough job with a gamma match, the gamma match, usually you change the length of the gamma rod and the capacitor that's in series with that gamma rod, and you play with the two of those until you get a good impedance match. But there's at least one more variable in your hand you may not be aware of, and that is the length of the driven element itself. As you make the driven element longer and shorter, you're changing the resistive component and you're changing the reactive component. Unfortunately, they move together and you don't have complete independence there. Although by way of the variable capacitor you've got on the gamma rod, you do have a variable capacitor. But if need be, you can always put one in shunt across the center of the driven element itself. Well, you can't do that with a gamma match. There is no opening in the center, but you know what I mean. Don't be afraid to use the driven element length as another variable. A lot of people think that there's something magic about the length of the driven element and they're not allowed to touch it. On top of that, when you do lengthen the driven element to raise the resistive component of impedance, like I'm suggesting, funny job, you will, on some occasions, make a driven element that is longer in physical length than the reflector. Don't let that scare you. The Yagi design is the length of those parasitic elements and their positions. The driven element only has to radiate like a dipole and give you a good impedance match. And if the driven element is a tiny bit longer than the reflector, don't worry about it. There are a ridiculous number of ham radio operators who were following my advice, lengthening the driven element. The pattern wasn't changing, the gain wasn't changing, the impedance match was getting better and better. At the instant the driven element approached the length of the reflector, they stopped. They were afraid the antenna would explode in their face if they went a millimeter beyond that length, that it wouldn't be a Yagi anymore, because everything in their spirit told them that the driven element, that the reflector had to be longer than the driven element in order for the Yagi effect to be true. I don't know where in the world that crazy idea came from, but you'd be amazed how many people are fighting with it. And there are some very respected moonbound operators today who don't have a good impedance match on their driven element because they refuse to add an extra millimeter when it becomes longer than the reflector. Craziness. But one of the guys in Brooklyn who's not crazy is Mel, K2KEY. Hey, Mel, straighten us all out on this. Your guys, when you do your shootouts, I wonder if you've ever had the ability, had the gumption to change the length of the driven element. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Now, the comment about a gamma match?
Yeah, we'll get back to you, Alex. Mel, you got it.
Okay, yeah, roger. Well, I was going to make a comment that I took a, somebody gave me a beam that was built years ago by Telrex, a 2-meter beam now. And it was a monster. It was a one of these long, you know, Telrex had the belief that all booms, everything has to be wide space. All their antennas were based on wide spacing. And so I went to modify it. I wanted to cut it down. It was too long, with too many elements and everything. I wanted it for, especially for our field day work, something that I could easily manage. And I wound up really taking everything apart, really. There's a lot to make it, you know, to, like you say, it's not a simple modification. But my question is, what was the thinking at the time, and was there any truth to it, or was it just more hype, that all their antennas were based on the elements going through the boom, not above, not below or anything, but through the boom, no insulation, except for the driven element, but everything else that was going through the boom, they claimed that that was the superior design thing. What was the story on that? I never asked you over.
Yeah, in 1956, one of the engineers working for Telrex published a series of articles in QST magazine that got him into a lot of trouble. The Telrex chain of command thought he was giving away the store. He was advertising the recipe, and was taking proprietary information and spread it to the world. And some of the information was the belief that the elements going through the boom is superior, pure hogwash. In fact, if the elements are insulated from the boom, it's better. And whether or not you make the design with the elements going through the boom or above the boom is your mechanical choice. It's a slightly different length of the element because the amount of magnetic shunting you get from the boom decreases as you make the element further and further above the boom in mechanical spacing. And when you put the element right through the boom, you get the maximum amount of magnetic shunting, and therefore you get a slight increase in the frequency of oscillation, the frequency of resonance of that element when it goes through the boom, insulated from the boom. And you can get away with, let me pick a number, a 3-element Yagi because it's a rather low Q structure. And so even if the elements are in contact with the boom and they break contact, the amount of detuning is minor when it comes to a 3-element Yagi. You go to an 8-element Yagi and you like those, you allow those elements to break contact with the boom, you've got a brand new design, and most likely you're going to be unhappy with it. The second thing that the series of articles from Telrex in 1956 said that there's some huge performance improvement when you go to ultra-wide spacing of the directors. People believe that. The particular engineer who wrote that, for the particular design he was working with, where in those days, they used to believe that you choose the right length of the director, you make all the directors the same length, and now you stagger the positions between them in order to come up with a Yagi design. Turns out that philosophy sounds good on paper. It is not good in practice. A real good Yagi design, you allow each individual element to be different in length as well as the spacing different. I call that the optimum design, when you allow all of the variables to take place. And some of the really good designs, the length of the element versus their position represents a Coke bottle shape. If you look down the edge of the Yagi, if you know what I mean. Sometimes the elements in the middle of the string of the directors are a little bit shorter than the ones on the end. Many of them taper.
Repeater, time out.
Many of the Yagi designs, the elements taper by various formulas in order to get greater bandwidth. And again, this is another one of the old wives' tales that a particular taper is going to give you a particular increase in bandwidth by the gain bandwidth product phenomena. Well, gain bandwidth product is a nice mathematical concept when you're talking about an operational amplifier. It, in general, is not true of a Yagi. There are Yagi designs that have near optimum gain and a whole lot of bandwidth. Those are the so-called DL6WU designs. There are other designs which have near optimum gain but very narrow bandwidth. There's an infinite number of Yagi designs. And which is the best one is an interesting question. Very few people have found more gain, more performance, or more bandwidth than the DL6WU designs. That's why he's called Herr Yagi. Mr. Yagi over there in Europe, and he's got the best published results on a lifetime of work. He works for the German Federal Post Office, the Research Institute. He had at his disposal a very large anechoic chamber, and he would take everybody's Yagi design, no matter what frequency it was on, scale it to 432, measure it in his anechoic chamber, and document the performance. You go to some of his past articles, and you'll find a large number of Yagi designs, maybe 15 or 20 Yagi designs, all plotted on a piece of paper as to what is their performance versus boom length and number of elements. And so you rapidly come to the conclusion that his design is essentially the optimal one of all the available ones. Maybe that answers some of your questions. We'll come back to you in a minute, Mel. Let's see what Alex wanted to add. N2NNU. Some further gamma match information. K2LAW on the deck net.
KC2QAQ.
Glenn recognized. You got it, Alex.
Yeah, okay. Just trying to make it short. There are several flavors of gamma match. The two large classes are where the capacitor and the inductor are separated, and you can actually adjust every one of those independently. Or the other one that has an integrated capacitor into an inductor, like the ReadyMatch from Cushcraft that I was cursing so much. So when you change the position of the tube to increase the capacitance or decreasing the capacitance, you're actually changing the inductance of the of the coil, also you're changing the inductance of the coil there. Well, coil is not really a good word here. So those two adjustments on the ready match, if you have one of those, are interdependent. So you have to be really, really careful what you're doing there, because there is only one single point where you can find that match, and it's really critical. That's what I wanted to add to that conversation. And now I'm going back to the boondocks. Back to you, Dick.
Understand, yeah. Tuning a gamma rod with its series capacitor in the usual embodiment, the way people build it, and the attachment point where it taps into the driven element, is not very difficult if you've got a good piece of instrumentation, like a network analyzer, standing wave ratio bridge, bird wattmeter, or whatever. If you can measure the percentage of reflected power, and you're tuning the variables of the gamma match, you'll pretty rapidly come into a design, in my opinion. In other words, you'll find the right tuning position. However, a lot of guys don't know. that you also are allowed to change the length of the driven element in the process. On top of that, common sense would lead you to believe, as you take the point of attachment of the gamma rod to the driven element, that block of metal out at the end, so to speak, you would think if you move that block of metal in and out, you're changing the resistive impedance match component. That's what everyone would believe. Not true. What's really happening, the major thing that's happening on both a gamma attachment point and a T-match, those two attachment points, as you move the blocks of metal in and out, you're changing the amount of capacitance at the end of the driven element. Therefore, you're tuning the driven element to a lower frequency by that capacitance. That's the main thing you're doing. The real transformer action between the gamma rod and the driven element takes place in the first few inches, so to speak. After that, you're just adding and subtracting capacitance. But as I said before, lots of ways of tuning that driven element. Don't be afraid to change the length of the driven element in order to come up with a good match. Glenn had a further question, KC2QIQ. Go ahead, Glenn.
I disagree with that, Dick.
I hear you, and I don't blame you. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's just I wanted to add a small comment about, attaching aluminum to aluminum. Granted, certainly if you can isolate the Yagi, definitely a much better way of going. But there's, a lot of applications where you have aluminum up in the air, and you have one element that has to be attached to another, or just even, attaching a boom and getting a good connection. One trick I've been using over the years is grinding down a lead weight on basically like a stone wheel until I wind up with basically like a lead powder. And I mix that with basically like wheel bearing grease. And what I do with this mixture is I slide it between all the surfaces of aluminum and where all the attachments are, and it basically acts as a grease, but it also has that electrical contact in between where the ground up or powderized lead is in between, and it actually makes a very, very good connection for years on the aluminum there, Dick. Just something I experimented with and I figured I'd share. Also, if you could put me on the list for a question, I have a question about Doppler antennas, if you don't mind answering a little bit later on down. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, you're on the list. Yeah, a lot of people have used this no-lock material, which guarantees good electrical contact between compression pieces of aluminum, and then they find various ways of wrapping it with tape and weatherproofing it. And your technique of embedded chunks of lead powder inside the grease, that's a pretty crafty technique. I presume you've already looked at the electromotive series, and you found out that aluminum and lead are compatible materials, which they are. In fact, I ran into a problem with my first 6-meter Yagi, which had a gamma match rod, and the attachment point between the gamma rod and the driven element, I did it with a homebrew copper strap. So now I had copper in direct contact with the aluminum. And for the first couple of months, the antenna worked very well. Then it started becoming flaky, because aluminum and copper are dissimilar metals that out in the weather should never be in contact with each other. They give you galvanic action, like a battery. It made a pasty, white, powdery mess in between the two and made very flaky contact. I got around the problem by cleaning it all up, coating the inner surface of that copper strap with solder by tinning it, because copper and solder are compatible, solder and aluminum are compatible, and now by having that intermediate layer of tin solder on the copper, good electrical contact was maintained after that, and the flakiness of the antenna went away. That was my solution. A better solution would have been to use probably an aluminum strap. But even then, I'd be building up aluminum oxide if I didn't put no-locks or the KC2QIQ lead powder in there with grease. Lots of ways of doing it. Okay, Alex, I think you want to make a further comment about gamma rods where you disagree with me. Gamma matching mechanisms and T-match. I know for a fact in the case of a T-match, when you move those blocks of metal out at the tips, in and out, and you're thinking you're changing the resistive component. Yes, you are changing the resistive component indirectly. Those blocks of metal out near the tips change the amount of capacitance. That, in turn, lowers the resonant frequency of the Yagi. That, in turn, changes the resistive component according to the Brown and Woodward curves in the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4. And that's the mechanism by which the resistance is changing. The transformer action that you think you're using is not working.
Repeater, timeout.
You think you're using transformer action by changing the length of either the folded dipole or the gamma match length of its rod. And it's not quite direct what all is taking place. The way most people build a gamma match rod is that the rod itself is two telescoping pieces of tubing that